So last week, I made the comment to you that I wouldn't say it's the traditional interpretation, but I would say that a traditional interpretation of the Lord's speeches is essentially, Job, you've been complaining about me, but I'm all powerful and I'm all wise, and you're neither of those things, so just button up. I think that's a fairly common understanding of these speeches. And I said to you that although clearly there is a lot that Job has been mistaken about and that the Lord corrects him on, I don't find that interpretation compelling. And I suggested to you that I think that the deeper issue that the Lord is getting at here is, Job, just because you don't always understand my work and my presence in your life, that doesn't mean that I'm absent from your life. And that's really the main point that I got from looking at the Lord's first speech, because as he traced out the different aspects of the created order, the inanimate world, stars, sun, snow, and the animate world, animals that are wild, that was really the theme that drew all of those passages together. No man saw God lay the foundation of the earth. But that doesn't mean God didn't do it. No man can see the rocky crags of where the eagle lives. But that doesn't mean the eagle isn't being taken care of. And all points in between in that first speech, I think that's really what the Lord was getting at. In much the same way that in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, consider the birds of the air. They neither toil nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father provides for them. Are you not much more valuable than they? All right, so that brings us then to the second speech of the Lord here in Job, which starts in Job chapter 40. After Job's initial response, how would you summarize Job's first response to the Lord? I think I'll be quiet from now on. Yeah, I think that's the way to kind of summarize this. And again, as I understand it, it's not because the Lord has just exerted this raw power that basically says, I'm big, bad, and strong, and you're not, so you should just be quiet. Rather, I think it's because the Lord has shown Job he was wrong about a lot of what he assumed. Namely, that God didn't care, that God wasn't interested, that God wasn't present in his life. All right, well, let's move on here now, and we're going to talk about the second major speech today. And I think the key to understanding this speech is to notice how this speech is prefaced here in chapter 40. If you look in verses 10 through 14, what sort of people does the Lord ask Job if he can deal with, if he can handle? Proud. That's exactly right. The proud and the wicked. So verse 10, adorn yourself with majesty and dignity, clothe yourself with glory and splendor, pour out the overflowings of your anger, and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who's proud and bring him low, and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together, bind their faces in the world below. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. In other words, Job, if you can take care of all the proud and wicked people, then I'll say, yeah, I'll listen to whatever you have to say, because you've got standing to talk with me as an equal. Now, do you remember previously in the book, has Job raised the issue of wickedness? Yes. In fact, we pointed out these examples of Job bringing up the problem of evil as an exception to what principle? Yeah, the principle of retribution. Yeah, we're not going to leave that behind. So go back to chapter 24 just for an instant, for an example here. Chapter 24 and verse 1, where Job asks these questions. Why are not times of judgment kept by the Almighty, and why do those who know him never see his days? And then he gives examples of evil things that people do, like moving landmarks, seizing flocks, taking the widow's ox for a pledge. Verse 4, thrust the poor off the road. And that makes the poor like wild donkeys. We commented on that. Happens to be one of the very animals the Lord raised in his first speech. In verse 10, they go about naked, without clothing, hungry, they carry the sheaves. Verse 12, from out of the city, the dying groan, the soul of the wounded cries for help. Yet God charges no one with wrong. So Job has raised this issue before, also in a couple other places, that it seems like there are people who are wicked who get away with it all. And the Lord begins this second speech by saying, okay, Job, what are you going to do about that? Can you do anything about that? Do you have the power to deal with the proud and the wicked? And of course, the obvious answer is no. Now, while everybody's attention likes to focus on the mysterious behemoth and Leviathan in the rest of this speech, it is crucial to bear in mind that the way the Lord introduces these animals is by first posing the question about wickedness. Can Job deal with the wickedness in the world? And the answer is no. All right, so then, question number two for tonight. The term behemoth in verse 15 is the plural for the general Hebrew term, which means beast. So you might translate it something like beast of beasts, beastiest of the beasts. That'd be the kind of thing here, all right? And I ask you the question, how is this term different from the terms used for the various animals in the first speech? Say that again. Yeah, exactly right. In the first speech, when the Lord brings up all those various animals, he just uses the normal words for those animals, right? Normal, we would probably call it like the normal zoological terms, just the normal standard designations for ox and eagle and ostrich, etc. But here, he doesn't do that. Here, when he talks about this animal, he talks about it in different terminology. Just bear that point in mind here as we go on. Now, in verse 15, what comparison does God draw between Job and this beast of beasts? Yes, he says, behold, behemoth, which I made as I made you, he eats grass like an ox. So, what the Lord brings up here is a central and basic point. Job, I created you, and Job, I created behemoth. Whatever behemoth is, you are both creatures. Now, at this point, I'm not ready to shift into interpretation mode. If you remember our How to Study the Bible class, here we're more like an observation mode. We're just simply looking at what the text itself says. But the fact that God raises the issue of behemoth as comparable in some way to Job certainly gives us a lot to chew on and to think about. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yes, Darren, exactly right. And I skipped over those verses. At the start of the second speech, the Lord says essentially what he does at the start of the first speech, right? Like, okay, get ready. And remember, that language is in connection with how Job has framed what he desires in the whole book. So remember, what does Job keep saying he wants in the book? Yeah, he wants to talk to God and especially talk to him in what kind of context? Yeah, dun dun, dun 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 dun. So see, I don't know why People's Court. The theme music just went into my. But yeah, he wants to go to court with God. It's a lawsuit. He's talked about it over and over again in the course of the book. So the Lord is basically saying, fine. You want a lawsuit? All right. Well, then let's go. But of course, we've already seen after the Lord's first speech, Job has retracted it. He no longer wants to pursue this because he realizes he was wrong. All right, well, let's move on here for the questions tonight. In verses 16 through 23, after describing the power of behemoth, what question does the Lord ask in verse 24? Can anyone capture? Can anybody capture him? The language, you know, pierce his nose with a snare, take him by his eyes. So let's just read these verses. Verse 16, his strength is in his loins. his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. He's the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. For the mountain yields food for him where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plant he lies in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. For his shade, the lotus trees cover him. The willows of the brook surround him. Behold, if the river is turbulent, he's not frightened. He is confident though Jordan rushes against his mouth. And then the language that we just read in verse 24. Can anybody control this beast, capture this beast? Can capture, I like that word that Dave just used. Can any man contain this beast? Now, there is an implicit answer to the question, if you think about it, that at least one can, right? What's the implicit answer? Exactly right, God can. Why did you say that? Exactly right, because God made Behemoth, like he made Job, he says. And you'll even notice it says in verse 19, let him who made him bring near his sword, as if to say, now God can do this, but Job, I'm asking you, can you handle Behemoth? And the obvious answer is no. Now again, is the point here simply to say, look what I can do and you can't? You know, just this raw exertion of power, is that the point? Well, maybe, that's what a lot of people think. If there's more to it than that, no, then just be thinking about who or what does Behemoth represent? What is it? What is its significance? And why would the Lord make these particular points? And remember, why would he make these points after prefacing them by asking Job questions about wicked people? Bear that in mind. All right, moving on. There's a chapter break, right? Verse 1 of chapter 41 brings up another creature, Leviathan. And again, an unusual term. It means in Hebrew something like twisting serpent, which means that it again, as Nancy pointed out, is not a normal word for an animal, like the animals we saw listed in the first speech of the Lord. There's no ox here, no donkey here. This is something very unusual. Now, there have been those who have suggested a possible identity for Behemoth and Leviathan by taking this poetic language as actually representing sort of a scientific description, and some people have taken it to refer to dinosaurs. Maybe you're familiar with this interpretation. And one kind of view of how all of this goes is, if you remember, the book of Job is set in the time of the patriarchs. It sounds very much like the book of Genesis. So, if the setting of Job was really, really, really early, let's say before the flood, then the theory is Behemoth and Leviathan are dinosaurs that Job and everybody else there knows and sees. But then the flood happened, and then the dinosaurs were killed off either in the flood or shortly thereafter. However, I pointed out to you, there is an enormous biblical problem with this position presented by Isaiah chapter 27 and verse 1, which says, in that day the Lord with his hard and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and slay the dragon in the sea. What problem does this passage in Isaiah pose to the dinosaur interpretation of Job 41? Yes, Dwayne? Wrong. No. Now, you know, it's interesting. I've listened to a lot of Marty's classes. And, you know, Marty was a little sneaky because he would often pose his questions like I am. I tend to make mine more open-ended. So now Dwayne says it doesn't pose any. I strongly disagree, though. Let me explain why.
It's describing a sea-bearing creature.
That's exactly right. The point of the interpretation is that Behemoth and Leviathan as dinosaurs were long since gone after the time of the flood. And yet, what is the time of the book of Isaiah? think I even said it in the question. Yeah, it's 700 years before the time of Jesus. Right. 700 years before the time of Jesus, 7 centuries before Jesus, whatever Leviathan is, Isaiah can still talk about it as a reality that the Lord needs to deal with. Say that again. The Loch Ness Monster. Yeah, well, I think this is going to get us pretty far afield here. Yeah. So, although as a Scot, you know, I have to say, I've always kind of liked the idea that there might be something over there. Yeah, so I don't think biblically this is going to hold up if you scrutinize it very carefully as an interpretation. All right, now I haven't said yet what I think the significance of these creatures may be. What I'm really trying to do at this point is to rule something out that I think has a lot of biblical problems to it. But I want you to just consider, okay, the context here starts with evil or wickedness, the idea of creatures that Job cannot control, but God can. Let's move on here then to the next question. What point is the Lord driving home by the questions that he raises here in the first 14 verses? Yeah, they are invincible to man, or at least Job's certainly not going to be able to defeat him. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or put him on a leash for your girls? I mean, can you make Leviathan into a little pet for your daughters? And of course, the whole point of all of these questions is what? No, Job can't do any of this. That's exactly right. No man, Job included, could possibly ever control Leviathan. The next question, you know, I did these questions a long time ago, and here's the problem. Sometimes I don't remember why I ask them like I did. So presumably I had some great different point to make by this question. I guess I was just restating the same thing, because the description in verses 15 through 34 obviously continues to suggest what about the ability of man to control Leviathan? Not going to happen. That's exactly right. And so verse 33, just to cut to the chase, on earth there is not his like, a creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all, the sons of pride. So yeah, nobody can control or contain Leviathan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And says, in that day, the Lord will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, with his fierce and great and mighty sword, even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, and he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea. That terminology of dragon is very closely associated with Satan himself. Is it at all possible that one of the things that God is suddenly doing here in chapter 41 is that Leviathan's not any kind? It may be partially, yes, some sort of terrestrial creature, but he's also kind of indicating he has control over the adversary as well. This accuser that appeared in chapter 1.
Dun, 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 dun. I think that is absolutely on target. No. Well, yeah, it was just, you know, it's going to be the big point that was my big reveal that I've spent all semester long raising. Yeah, that's it. No. Yeah, so Andrew just made the comment here, you know, this language about dragon. Well, think about it. What other book of the Bible uses dragon language? Where does it use it? Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I guess that was unfair. Was it all right? Well, wait a minute. You college kids, we study Revelation. You don't remember everything we studied the first quarter of last year? So in Revelation chapter 12, and in Revelation chapter 12, verses 9 and 10, how is the dragon identified?
The serpent of old.
Yeah, the serpent of old, which is?
Satan.
Yeah, the devil. And then think about this, just to carry on a little bit here. In the next chapter of Revelation, in chapter 13, the dragon summons two allies. Where are these allies from? That's exactly right. One of them is a beast from the sea, and the other is the beast from the land. I wonder maybe where you could get ideas like that. So I think you all are absolutely right on target. Yeah, Darren?
I just wanted to say, I don't think, you know, by looking at it, these are things that they've passed down in folklore through history. You know, there was a big beast, you know, I don't think it was an elephant or, you know, woolly mammoth or something specific. It was just something that he would just describe, a big thing that they couldn't control. And Leviathan was a big thing. It might have been a whale that they saw, but they just described it as something that they couldn't really describe, something that they could control or they knew they couldn't defeat. And he's just using that, and you know, for Job to understand that he could even beat the biggest things that they think they know they can't.
Yeah.
You know?
So Darren is making a point that I want to build off of here in just a second, but I saw a hand up over here just a second. Yeah, really? Yeah, very. Y'all are raising, I think, very, very perceptive questions. So let me offer you some thoughts about how to look at these, you know, very mysterious creatures here in the book. We understand the concept of using animals to represent powers. I would just give you an example. If I were to say, what country do you associate with, what animal do you associate with Russia? It would be the bear. That's right, the Russian bear. And if you're an old-time wrestling fan, Ivan Koloff was the Russian bear, all right? And then if I mention China, what animal would you say? Yeah, the dragon. That's exactly right. America, of course, is the eagle. So Benjamin Franklin wanted it to be the turkey, by the way, but... we went with the eagle instead. So we are, and even in our culture, not in ancient culture, even in our culture, we know how to sometimes convey truths using animals, but we mean more than the animal, right? In fact, it conveys something like a world power, a government power. Not only that, but even in our culture, we use animals sometimes to represent abstract concepts, right? So if what animal represents wisdom? The owl. That's exactly right, an owl. Now, why is that? Well, if you traced it back, there's undoubtedly centuries of cultural layers that went into that. But for whatever reason, in our culture at least, the owl represents wisdom. If I ask you what animal represents memory, what would you say? The elephant. Or college football excellence, right? What animal represents college basketball excellence? The wildcat, obviously. So we are very familiar with these abstract concepts. So an animal can represent a quality or a concept. Or a tiger. Or... Or a war eagle. Yeah, that's exactly right. All right. So we are familiar with that idea. Well, it's no great surprise to us that in the ancient world, they did the same thing. For example, you remember in the book of Daniel that in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about world empires. Remember, in that dream, how are the world empires conveyed? A statue that's comprised of different elements. In chapter 7, how is the same point made? Remember? Yeah, it's animals. It's animals. They're kind of weird, souped-up animals. Let me just show you this. Here, I go over to Daniel chapter 7. So I'm going through all of this just simply to say that we all know that one of the first rules of Bible interpretation is you have to interpret things in the context of what these things would mean to the people the Bible was written to. And that's what I'm really trying to get at here with understanding Leviathan and Behemoth. So if you look in Daniel chapter 7, it says in verse 2, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven were stirring up the great sea. And by the way, in Revelation 12 and 13, this is where the beasts come from, the beast of the sea. Four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. The second, in verse 5, is like a bear raised up on one side with three ribs in its mouth. The third is like a leopard, verse 6, with four wings of a bird on its back. So this is a souped-up leopard, right? And it has four heads, dominion. And then verse 7 just talks about a terrible, dreadful, exceedingly strong beast. All right, so I'm just making some basic points here, which are that in the ancient world, like in our world, animals or animal-like creatures could take on a symbolic significance. They communicated a message. All right. Now, recall that I pointed out to you that in chapter 41, the entire discussion of these animals, as the Lord makes this speech, is prefaced by the issue of the wicked. Can Job control and contain wicked people? Wickedness. The obvious answer being no. And it's interesting that as the Lord talks about these animals, he brings up the same kind of issue, right? Job, can you contain them? Can you control them? Can you capture them? So what I'm suggesting that you start to think about is, if you lived in the ancient world and you heard talk of creatures like this, would there be any significance in your world that would somehow in some way associate these creatures with the very thing the Lord raised with Job when he brought him up to begin with, namely the issue of chaos or evil or wickedness? Now, it's really interesting to me that several of you tonight, as we were reading this language, immediately went to biblical descriptions of Satan. And it might interest you to know that some of the ancient commentators of the book of Job, like Thomas Aquinas, said that ultimately that's what these are conveying. That's what these represent. That it's very much like a picture, just like in Revelation chapter 12 and chapter 13. I think we can take this point just a little bit further, though, because we actually have in archaeology examples of these very sorts of pictures being used to convey this point. So I'll just show you a couple of them here. In Egyptian thought, of course, in Egyptian thought, they had the belief in, you know, many different gods with many different purposes. And one of the gods who was a bad guy was the god, we would probably say Seth. They would probably say something like Set, who is a murderer. And in their stories, Horus hunts down Seth, or Set, to punish him for the evil that he has done. Now, I realize, let me go out here, actually. It's probably hard to see this, because honestly, it was hard even on the computer screen to make it out. And out here on this screen, I'm not so sure. Oh, no, actually, it looks not too bad. Can you all see a couple of hippos here, hippopotami here? So trust me, Horus would not be singing, I want a hippopotamus for Christmas, because he wanted to hunt down and kill Set. But in this sketching or etching, the way Set is portrayed is as a hippopotamus. Show you another example. Would you like to take a wild guess what other animal was sometimes used to symbolize Set, the force of evil and chaos? Yeah, there it is right there. Here's Horus spearing Set in the form of a crocodile. Well, Shane, are you saying that the behemoth, the leviathan, or hippo, and a crocodile? No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is this, that we know that in the ancient world, those creatures were used to convey a point. And they're used to convey a point about creatures that are incredibly deadly and powerful and dangerous. So if you're like me, you think of the hippo as this fat, lovable creature. Turns out, not so much. The deadliest creature in Africa. Kills more people than any other creature in Africa. At least if the one National Geographic special I saw is any indication. And of course, the crocodile is very vicious. But if you ever watched The Crocodile Hunter, you may remember there was an episode where he hid on a bank and watched crocs and hippos go at it. Because there was a hippo that had died and the crocs were coming in on the carcass and they had this huge... And he made the point about these being the two deadliest creatures in that part of the world. So what I am suggesting is this. If there's evidence that in the ancient world they took these animals, and then if I said to you they put these animals on steroids, that picture, these animals on steroids, conveyed powerful symbolic truth about chaos and evil and wickedness. Just exactly what Darren was saying a minute ago, that this sounds like something that you could just see was passed down as an image of really, really, really ugly stuff. And just like several of you pointed out, Rhodey and Andrew pointed out, you know, in certain respects, this sounds a lot like some of these biblical pictures that talk about the devil as the serpent of old and the dragon. Again, not because we're trying to make some identification with a particular species of snake and the devil, but it's conveying a powerful truth given that day and time. Now, to me, what really adds weight to seeing these designations of Behemoth and Leviathan in this light are two things. First of all, because of the way the Lord introduced the animals by first of all talking about the issue of wickedness. But the other reason is because of the big picture of the book. I ask you all, how does this portrait of creatures beyond the power of man to control, but within the power of God to control, how does that, which is obviously the point, right? Whether I'm off base or not in my specific idea, clearly this is the point that the Lord's getting at, right? Job, you can't control these creatures, I can. Whatever the meaning is, all right? How does that relate to the opening chapters of the book? Yeah, it's exactly right. Exactly right. If you think about it, the way the book starts off is with this picture of Satan the accuser, and he's able to do some bad stuff, but completely under the control, the constraining power of God himself. Now, the thing is, does Job realize that? No, he does not. In fact, he keeps saying, you know, God's forsaken me, deserted me, abandoned me, doesn't care about me. He used to care for me, used to hedge me. He does not. Well, we know because of our, you know, perspective on the book from the opening two chapters, that isn't at all the case. As a matter of fact, Job, you should know that God is preserving and protecting you by limiting what the Satan can do to you. To me, that point coupled with this ancient background really kind of brings together what the whole point of these speeches is that the Lord is making to Job. The first speech, the Lord is saying, as you recall, Job, you said that you feel like a wild ox and an ostrich, and you see the poor abandoned like wild donkeys. And that's how you think of yourself. Well, Job, did you know somebody feeds the wild donkeys and the wild ox and the ostrich? Oh, you don't see that? I know you don't, but that's a different issue. The issue is somebody taking care of them even though you don't see it? The answer is yes. All right, by the same token, what I think the Lord is saying to Job here is essentially this. Job, can you do anything to control or restrain the evil and wickedness in the world? No, you're powerless. But that doesn't mean nobody can do anything about it. And I think that ultimately, this is what the Lord is conveying to Job. Yeah.
I can't help but think that he's talking to all
Yeah, so Justin is saying, you know, that this is a point not simply for Job, but for all of us who read the book, right? And if you think about what the Lord is saying here, if you will accept, at least just for the sake of argument, just to contemplate this idea of these animals having a larger symbolic significance than just really mean, nasty animals, but representing at least what in Egyptian culture they did as forces of chaos and evil, then when the Lord says to Job things like, you know, you can't do anything about Behemoth. Behemoth is under my power. You can't do anything about Leviathan. If I wanted to, I could put a chain around Leviathan's neck and make it a toy for my daughter. You can't do that, but I can. Then ultimately, what the Lord would be asking Job, I think, is, Job, you can't do anything about the chaos and evil in the world, but I can. Will you trust me? Does that make sense to you guys? Will you trust me? Yeah, Dwayne? Sure, sure.
I think it's more like how we refer to God, the Lord of Lords, King of Kings. He was just, and he may have been making a specific reference to something that was kind of out. I think it was more along the lines of, if you control the greatest land animal,
right, right.
Or the greatest sea.
I think you're exactly right. Yeah, and if anybody listens to this recording years from now, and it sounded like I snapped at Dwayne at the start. We're really good friends, and we were smiling and laughing the whole time. Everybody, laugh, everybody. Yeah, see that? We're all in good spirits right here. No, Dwayne, I actually think the way you just summarized it is a beautiful way. You know, the greatest land and the greatest sea creatures. It would be a great way to kind of summarize this point. Yeah, Brad? Yeah, that's right. In other words, you're not going to be able to handle this. All right, so now I wanted to just really stop here, except I do want to cheat ahead a little bit. Look on into chapter 42, the first two verses. How does Job answer God? I know you can do everything, and no purpose of yours. How does Job answer this question? Yes. I'm going to trust you. Now, here's the interesting thing. Has Job gotten a single camel back yet? No. Has one scale been healed on his body? Nope. Are his children still dead? But I think what Job just said is, you say you can handle this, I believe you. I believe you.
Well, I really think that's all he was really looking from God, is not really to debate him or argue with him in the court of law or anything like that. He was just wanted to have something, God say something to him to make him, you know, feel that he could trust him.
Yeah. I mean, I think Darren's right in the sense that I think when all of us in our dark moments cry out to God in frustration and anger, that's exactly why, right? We just sometimes don't get it and we don't understand, and we want answers. And the Lord gives us an answer. It's just not an answer like, okay, let me explain everything. Like here he doesn't explain to Job why Job, when I talk about Behemoth and Leviathan, I actually mean the accuser, and up in heaven, he wanted to do things, and I'm controlling him. He doesn't explain any of that to Job. He just says, Job, you can't deal with this, but I can. Will you trust me? I think that's what he's saying. And I think that is one of the great challenges a lot of us face, maybe all of us do, to one extent or the other. Can we trust God even if he doesn't answer every one of our questions? Do we have reason to? Now, that doesn't mean, is it easy to? It's heartbreaking to. But do we have reason to trust God Now, if you think about the answers that we can give as Christians, and you factor in the death and resurrection of Jesus as an answer to this question, do we have reason to trust God? Then, even more so than Job, I'm sure, could have ever dreamed, right? That's one of the reasons, quite frankly, I think he is presented to us as a hero in the New Testament when James says, consider the patience of Job. Living even on that side of the cross, as far before the cross as he did. The fact that the Lord came to him and addressed him and made these points to him leads Job to simply say, it's in your hands, I'm going to trust in that. And I think as all of us go through the questions that we have in life, that we just have to ask ourselves, is there reason to think God is powerful enough and faithful enough that though we're often confused and perplexed, that at the end of the day, he will make things right, that he can control the evil and bring it to an end. And obviously, I think as Christians, we can answer that question. Yeah, doesn't make it easy. Doesn't make it easy. But it's the confession of a just and upright man who feared God and turned away from evil. Yeah, Brad.
God never tells Job, I don't think, why what happened to him happened. He never tells him, well, you know, we had this contest, honey.
Right. Yeah, and I think that Brad's point is so important for us to remember. We may never know the reasons why some terrible thing happens. That's just the nature of life. But what we can know is that God is in control, and we believe, like Joseph says to his brothers, that what is meant for evil, God can mean for good. And we can see examples of that, and most of all, every first day of the week, we commemorate that very truth, that God works through even evil circumstances to bring about greater good. And that's what gives us hope and confidence. All right, well, consider that. I know that was deep waters tonight in a way, but that's the best sense I know how to make out of this passage. Next week, we are just going to cover four verses. But it just so happens that Job 42, verses 3 through 6, is filled with all kinds of tough, difficult, interesting questions. And really, it would be a shame if you had been here this whole semester. Oh, man. And you missed that class. Wow. I mean, what a shame that would be. I mean, it'd almost be worth hanging around for another week down here so that you wouldn't miss that class. But anyway, Lord willing, that's what we'll get to next week.
Good thing it's recorded.
That's right. It's recorded.